Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, the complicated and little-known history of gun laws in America. Monday, as we talked about gun policy and politics, I heard from a number of you with questions about how we got here, what the Second Amendment was meant to say, and how our history influences the modern-day debate. Adam Winkler is the perfect go-to guest for those questions. He's a professor of law at UCLA and the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. His newest book, which I've read, is called We the Corporations. We may get to a couple questions about that as well. So, Adam Winkler, a lot to accomplish here. Welcome. Good to have you here with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you have questions about the history of gun laws and how they shape our debates, this is your opportunity. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Adam, the gun debate was renewed 3 weeks ago after the shooting in Parkland. And what I want to know, I know you have a finely tuned ear for this. Do you hear anything different? Does this sound different to you in the wake of Parkland?
It does sound different. I remember the day of the shooting, some reporters called me and asked me whether I thought anything would change in the wake of that shooting. And I thought, almost certainly not, not with Republicans in control of the White House and Congress and the Republican Party currently being dead set against new restrictive gun laws. But it does seem like the mobilization we've seen on behalf of gun violence prevention efforts has been really remarkable. And these students have really breathed new life into the gun debate. In a way that does seem to be shifting the ground as we speak.
Okay, so if you're listening to Washington, it's sounding pretty similar. If you're listening to activism outside Washington and maybe tuning into what's being discussed at state capitals, it sounds different.
Well, I do think we are going to see different reactions. I mean, I think it's been surprising so far to see the reaction we've seen from the federal government. I mean, we haven't seen new laws passed, but the president, as unpredictable as he is, seems to have come out in favor of broad new restrictions. We've seen some movement from very strong Second Amendment supporters like Marco Rubio. So we may see some more movement there. However, I do think it's a mistake to underestimate the strength of the NRA, especially at the state level. In many states, the NRA is really the most powerful political force around, and they're not going to allow any new gun control laws adopted too quickly.
We're going to talk about the influence of the NRA because we discussed that at length yesterday. I want to come back to what you said about Marco Rubio. Here he is in that CNN town hall meeting in Florida, and he's talking about high-capacity magazines. Let's listen.
And I'm glad you asked that question because I traditionally have not supported looking at magazine clip size. And after this and some of the details I've learned about it, I'm reconsidering that position, and I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. Because while it may not prevent an attack, it may save lives in an attack.
What do you hear in that, Adam?
I hear a certain fear that usually is reserved for elected officials expressing their concerns about the NRA. You know, I do think that what we're seeing is that these people, a lot of people have really raised their voices, and elected officials, which have felt for a long time, that when it comes to Election Day, the only single-issue voters on the question of guns are really pro-gun voters. And mm-hmm. So they always had to worry about those voters. A lot of people support gun control laws, but they don't actually vote on the basis of gun control laws. I think elected officials like Marco Rubio are now starting to feel there's a possibility that there's a growing number of single-issue pro-gun violence prevention voters, and that would be a real significant sea change in American politics.
I am so glad you brought this up because we spent quite a bit of time yesterday talking about how the fact that the NRA is not the largest organization with the most money that lobbies on and weighs out its influence on Capitol Hill. But what it has is a number of members who prioritize their views on guns, and they prioritize it when they vote. Isn't that the difference between why the NRA is as successful as it is and other activist groups that, as you say, are full of members who have a lot of things that they want to accomplish.
I think it's absolutely accurate. I think, look, the NRA is a wealthy organization, and it's hard to be really successful in American politics without a good amount of money. So it's not like the money is irrelevant to the NRA's power. But the NRA's sway really comes from the ability to move voters on election day, especially in primary elections. With our extreme partisan gerrymandering, most general elections are not competitive. It's really the primary campaigns that bring out the most extreme voters and where single-issue pro-gun voters have really led the day. But we do seem to be seeing some variation. One thing that gun owners have that makes their political mobilization easier is that it's a lifestyle. It's a hobby. It's a sport. It's something they do every weekend. Whereas for gun violence prevention advocates, it's just another policy position. It's an important one, but it's not a lifestyle and an identity, and it doesn't make mobilization as easy as it does for the gun pro-gun people.
I was thinking about this as I was reading some demographic info that Ron Brownstein from The Atlantic was tweeting this morning. He says the trend is toward change. Just from 2010 to 16, the number of districts where minorities equal 40% or more of the population increased by 22. Now non-whites hit that threshold in 171 seats. The other thing that he makes the point of, though, is that Republicans far outrepresent those districts where whites are still the majorities in the districts, which I think comes back to what you were saying about gerrymandering and the power of the NRA.
That's right. And it also points to a certain demographic challenge that the NRA has going forward, because it has been very popular and very successful in recent years. But we are seeing a shifting demographic tide in America, where growing numbers of racial and ethnic minorities, communities that tend to be very favorable towards gun violence prevention efforts and less favorable to the right to bear arms. We're seeing growing numbers of people living in urban areas, growing number of people getting college education. All these things are at least roughly associated with stronger support for gun control laws. So it could be that the broader demographic challenges that we've talked about in terms of, say, the Republican Party over the last 10 years and its future are going to confront the NRA, too.
Call here from Sue in Maplewood, Minnesota. Hi, Sue. What do you want to ask?
Well, I'm just curious about the history, the change from when people started thinking that gun ownership was a God-given right versus a constitutional right.
Do you think that's how people perceive this, Adam?
I think many people in the gun community view it as a constitutional right that reflects a God-given right, a right that was awarded to people long before the formation of the Constitution, resting in a notion of self-defense. But we have seen real shifts in the history of the gun debate. It's important to recognize that for most of its history, for instance, the NRA didn't even claim that the Second Amendment protected a right of individuals to have guns for personal protection. And the NRA generally supported gun control laws for most of its history. It's really only over the last 30, 40 years where the NRA has really taken a very hard turn towards the extreme and the no compromises approach that we've come to know it.
What was the reason for that?
Well, I think it's reflecting the views of a group of hardliners in the membership. I mean, if you look at the actual date, we can trace this change in the gun debate to one night in 1977 when the leadership of the NRA was planning on retreating from political activity and moving the headquarters to Colorado Springs. And this angered a group of hardliners in the membership who really thought in a time of rising crime rates that we needed guns for personal protection. They staged a coup at that annual membership meeting, replaced the entire board of the NRA with new people who are committed to political advocacy and fighting gun control. And America's sort of never been the same since.
Here's a question on Twitter that intersects with your newest book and your also your area of expertise here on guns. A listener asks, was there such an emphasis on citing the Second Amendment for every and anything before the NRA had dug its nails into Congress? Would repealing Citizens United help release the NRA's grip at all?
Ooh, that's a very good question, right? The ties between moneyed power and large and the gun makers is an interesting one. I do think that the NRA's power comes largely from voters, whereas businesses are especially politically powerful in issues of slightly less salience. You know, where there's a big political controversy and voters really focus on it, then business influence tends to be a little bit less effective. But they're very, very effective where voters are paying a little less attention. And one of the interesting things we've seen in the gun debate is we've seen these companies like Delta and United rise up and sort of express their protest against the NRA by pulling back these programs. It's an example of sort of corporations being much more politically active than we might expect.
Follow up here to what was asked on Twitter there. Did you remark over the question that Senator Rubio was asked in that town hall meeting about taking NRA money? And do you remember what his answer was about, in essence, being beholden to the NRA because he took the campaign money?
And I guess there are some officials who feel that way. And we saw that in the tax bill where we had elected officials saying that they had to support this tax bill because the donors were really insisting upon it. It was kind of a quite blatant example of the kind of quid pro quo corruption that occurs in our campaign finance system. And what's happened is in recent years, the Supreme Court's opened that even more by with cases like Citizens United, allowing corporations to spend unlimited amounts of money and claiming the same free speech right as individuals.
Yeah, one of the things that Senator Rubio said that night was, well, I set the agenda, that comes out of what I believe in, and they support that agenda. They don't set the agenda, and then I follow them. And, well, this is what politicians have been saying forever about lobbying money. I don't know that there's any real way to call him on that.
Well, there's no way to call them on that. It's just one of the endemic problems of a system in which there is a lot of money. I think it's a complicated situation, though. I mean, I think that there's a lot of elected officials that would support more reasonable gun control laws, but they're very much afraid of being primaried, of going and facing a challenger in the next primary election that wins the NRA's endorsement and thus brings out the vote and the people then lose their jobs. It's not surprising that the NRA – that people kowtow to the NRA when elected officials are really fearful of the NRA's voters. One of the things I think we've seen from the Delta and other airlines that have curtailed their policies with the NRA is that I think that's in part a response to concerns about consumer demands.
Yeah.
And eventually, if the consumers are making those demands on businesses, eventually they're going to make those demands on elected officials too.
I guess those elected officials at the Georgia State Legislature weren't too worried about it when they pulled their tax increment financing for Delta. Right. But there were plenty of cities that said, well, then come make your headquarters here. At the moment, Georgia politicians don't seem to be too worried about this.
No, they're not. And it goes to show you that even though Delta is a very influential player in Georgia politics, the NRA is a more influential player. When it comes down to it, who are you going to follow, the corporations or are you going to follow the NRA? I guess the NRA is the one who wins in the end.
It kind of blows my mind. For now, or do you think for where we're at, you don't see any indication that that's going to change anytime soon? Or is that in question?
I think it remains to be seen. I mean, I think, look, it's hard to imagine this Congress, which is dysfunctional and can't get legislation passed on a lot of issues, is going to tackle in any kind of comprehensive and effective way the gun violence prevention problem. It's kind of inconceivable, but it could happen. We've seen more movement than we have expected in recent weeks. We're likely to see much more activity at the state level. The states will go different directions. Some states like California and Colorado are going to probably make their laws more restrictive. But other states like Georgia and Mississippi might make their laws more permissive.
Adam Winkler is with us if you've just joined in. He's a professor of constitutional law at UCLA. We are talking about some of the questions that came up yesterday in our conversation about policy and politics around guns, because he's the author of a book called Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. But he is also out with a new book called We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. And we're actually learning that there's some intersection here between his two areas of expertise. Questions from you this morning on the history of gun laws, how they shape our debates, where the idea of corporations as people might fit into that. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828 on Twitter at @CarrieNPR to Joe in Minneapolis. Hi, Joe. What are you asking Adam about?
Hi. Good morning. I just wanted to see your guest's opinion on the Heller case, the U.S. Supreme Court decision from 2008, because, you know, it seems that though Heller said the right to bear arms is a personal right, not just being part of a militia, mm-hmm. it also seemed to have left a wide area for regulation, you know, regulation of military-type weapons. So what does your guest think about the impact of Heller?
And Adam, will you again reiterate what Heller actually said?
Sure. The 2008 Supreme Court decision in District of Columbia against Heller was the first Supreme Court case ever to clearly and unambiguously hold that the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to have guns for personal protection. So it was really an important landmark victory for the gun rights movement. Interestingly, though, the Supreme Court in that case made it crystal clear that many forms of gun control remain constitutionally permissible. And while many gun owners who want to fight gun control were celebrating the Heller case when it was decided in 2008, the results have been pretty mixed. And in fact, since the Heller case, the vast majority of gun control laws have been upheld by the federal courts, and we haven't seen a significant curtailment of America's gun control laws. I think that's kind of predictable in some ways. I think the Heller case embodied really what Americans think about guns, which is, yeah, people do have a right to have guns for personal protection, but we can and should do more to keep guns out of the hands of the mentally ill and the others and felons and others who can't be trusted to have firearms.
Part of this is the language and the terms we use in this debate. I don't, as you just said, that you think the Heller case reflects where most average Americans are. The political debate doesn't, does it?
No, it really doesn't. But it really shows that in a democracy, it's not just a matter of sheer numbers. It's also about intensity. And the intensity and mobilization of certain interest groups, can, even if they're a small minority, can have a huge impact on elections. And so I think that's what we have in the world of guns. When, I remember when universal background checks were proposed after the Newtown shooting.
Right.
And Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, yep. a rookie Democratic senator, said that the calls to her office were running 7-1 against background checks, even though polling showed that it was 9-1 in favor of background checks. And what that shows is that there's a really intense, politically active, mobilized minority in favor of very robust gun protections, and they're outplaying the gun control folks.
Which I'm sure she knew, too, when she said that. I mean, if you are to believe that these are just average voters in her state who are calling in, then you're missing the power of the organization. You know, call it phone trees and those kinds of things that the NRA is pretty good at.
Absolutely. And look, elected officials know that the NRA's voters are very politically engaged. They follow politics closely. They vote on the basis of the gun issue, even when there's no realistic possibility of gun control laws being enacted, because mm-hmm. it's just kind of an identity issue. It's really important to some people, and it really does impact our elections.
A call here from Mike in St. Paul. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Question.
You know, whenever we talk about the Second Amendment, we should focus on the first four words. I'm a big Second Amendment supporter, in particular those first four words. And the plain language tells us that the framers anticipated regulation. And, you know, in this environment where public safety is really threatened by gun violence, we should regulate the availability and lethality of weapons, and to not do so is a shirking of one's constitutional responsibility.
So, Mike, you want to zero in on this phrase of a well-regulated militia. What
exactly.
did the framers mean? Okay. Adam?
It's such a great point. I mean, I think the Second Amendment nicely encapsulates two ideas, both a right to bear arms and the necessity of a well-regulated militia, that the people who own – the civilians who own guns need to be regulated. The founders recognized the importance of gun rights. They were armed revolutionaries when push comes to shove. That's what they did. And so they believed in that idea. At the same time, they recognized that we needed reasonable regulation on firearms. The founders had gun control laws. They didn't call them that, but that they banned certain people from possessing firearms, not only African-Americans, both slave and free, but also loyalists. People who refused to swear an oath of loyalty to the revolution would be subject to forcible disarmament. And the framers had laws, for instance, in Boston prohibiting the possession of a loaded weapon at any time in any building because of the possibility of a fire hazard. The framers recognized that guns were dangerous and wanted them to be regulated.
Good question here from Jeff on Twitter, who says, can you ask Professor Winkler to speak about how the Black Panthers in California, who started the idea that the Second Amendment granted an individual a right to own a gun, and the Reagan and California legislature, that was Governor Reagan at the time, and the California legislature actually passed gun control laws after a Black Panther demonstration at the Capitol. So I've been reading about this. Does he have the history right?
Well, yeah. I tell the story in my book, Gunfight. It's really one of the most amazing spectacles in the history of the gun debate. And it's a day in May of 1967 when 30 members of the Black Panthers marched right into the California Capitol, openly carrying loaded rifles, pistols, and shotguns. And they weren't there to commit violence. They were there to protest a proposed gun control law. Conservatives in California sought to disarm the Panthers, who were conducting police patrols in Oakland to protect Black residents. And social conservatives like Ronald Reagan came out and said there's no reason why someone should be carrying guns on the streets today. And there were new laws enacted to restrict access to guns by the Black Panthers and other Black radicals. And ironically, some of these laws helped fuel the rise of the modern gun rights movement, a movement that's famous for being white, rural, and politically conservative.
Call here from Kelly in Minneapolis. Hi, Kelly. Your question for Adam.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about the fact that people who believe that assault rifles and, you know, machine guns should have no place in a civil society, that's a perspective that never gets represented in terms of, you know, civil dialogue. And, you know, I've had members of my family who've been killed and murdered by these weapons. I had a neighbor who committed suicide after purchasing one from Dick's Sporting Goods. And, you know, there's just never any kind of discussion about, you know, about, you know, people who have that belief that these guns absolutely never should be allowed into civil society, not for hunting or any other reason.
Kelly, this is a really good point because, Adam, I think she's zeroing in on the all or nothing approach that the NRA takes to this, which seems to limit the nuance of the debate. Now, maybe that's lifting a bit in state capitals, but it doesn't seem to be in Washington. What's your insight on that?
Well, I think that's right. And I think the caller makes an important point about some people feel very strongly that there are some kinds of arms that don't belong in a civilized society. And the truth is, we all kind of agree with that principle, but there is some disagreement over where to draw the line. So we all agree that you shouldn't have shoulder-launched missiles. And while people often think that machine guns are legal, actually they've been prohibited for sale since 1986. So the assault weapons that we know today are not machine guns, that term is generally understood. But these military-style rifles have become incredibly popular. They do shoot a lot of rounds at once because they carry these high-capacity magazines. And they have been the target of significant efforts to regulate. I will say one of the reasons why gun violence prevention advocates don't emphasize restricting these weapons so much is because they're actually involved in relatively few crimes and few murders, whereas handguns are much more commonly the source of violence.
One of the things is being debated anew is the idea of arming school personnel and teachers, right, carrying firearms if they want to. But I thought I remembered this from your book, Gunfight, that if we go back to Columbine, there were armed guards on the campus of Columbine, weren't there? Wasn't there an armed guard who was shooting at the shooters?
And there was an armed guard in Parkland.
That's right.
Who didn't shoot at
That's
the shooters. Right. It's actually pretty commonplace. We often hear that these shootings occur in gun-free zones. But that's often not the case. And the truth is, as some people think that arming teachers or having armed guards will deter a shooter because the shooter doesn't want to die. But the vast majority of mass shooters do die in their incident, and most of them commit suicide before they're shot by the police or someone else. So it seems that for many of these mass shooters, they're expecting to die. And even the existence of armed personnel on campus, probably not going to discourage them, unfortunately.
Question here on Twitter. Would you ask your guest about gun control and murder rates in the Old West? This is something that you've talked about with us before. He says in places like Tombstone, Deadwood, and Dodge City.
Well, that's right. I mean, we have this bizarre image of the Wild West where everyone was carrying guns night and day, and there were shootouts at high noon on a regular basis. But it turns out nothing could be further from the truth. It turns out that the frontier towns in the Wild West, places like Tombstone or Dodge City, they had the most restrictive gun control laws in the nation. You were not allowed to carry your guns on the streets in Tombstone, Arizona. By the way, today's in Tombstone, the gun control laws are at least in some measure looser than they were back in the Wild West days, because today you can carry a gun in Tombstone without even having a permit. So the gun laws were very different, and actually gun violence was not nearly as common as we think. These towns in the Wild West averaged fewer than one murder a year during the height of the Wild West period. So the shootouts were pretty rare. When they did happen, they became national news, and indeed the shootout at the OK Corral, the most famous shootout of the Wild West, three people died, and we're still talking about it 150 years later, showing how extraordinary it really was rather than how commonplace it was.
You know that there's a debate around these age restrictions for access to these AR-15 rifles. I know the amount of federally funded research on gun violence is all but nothing because of the Dickey Amendment. But is there some research that would tell us about whether moving the age up to 21, as I think Florida is debating right now, really stops the kind of violence that we've been seeing?
Well, I think we have to have reasonable goals for any kind of reform in this area. Is it going to stop this kind of violence? No. I mean, there's no laws that are going to stop these murders and things from happening, at least sometimes. You just want to make it that much harder for someone to commit these crimes and to lower the incidence, lower the rate that they happen. That's really all you can ask for. And what we do know is that actually criminal violence is concentrated among young people, and that people under the age of 21 are far more likely, because of just brain development issues, to make the kinds of bad judgments that result in criminal behavior. And if we can make it that much harder for young people to get their hands on guns, I think we can help bring down the daily death toll from gun violence.
Okay. So to be clear about what you've just said, though, it might affect the amount of crimes that are committed with a certain kind of gun. It might not affect, you know, in a statistically significant way, what happens with these mass shootings. Is that right?
Well, I think mass shootings in particular are a very difficult social problem to solve. We have a country with 350+ million guns. That's a lot of guns. And
wow,
if someone's really determined, like the Las Vegas shooter, a guy who's willing to plan and plot, or if someone's really been considering this for some time, like apparently the Parkland shooter was, those people will be able to get their hands on guns probably. You know, there's just so many of them, and there's a black market. What we need to do is adopt laws that will bring down the daily death toll from gun violence and hopefully affect some of these mass shootings too. And we can't have laws like gun violence prevention orders, restraining orders that families and friends can ask a judge to impose and take away someone's guns for a very short period of time if that person's undergoing incredible stress or mental illness. There are things that we can do to help bring down the mass shootings, but there's no like magic remedy where if we do this one thing, there won't be any more mass shootings.
You've reminded me of the situation in Sandy Hook, where Adam Lanza was known to have mental health problems. His parents knew it, but his mother provided him with a key to their gun safe. How do you legislate against something like that?
Well, you know, all you can do is put laws in place that give you the best tools to lower the death toll from gun violence. And nothing is perfect. I do think that it's in the gun area more than any, we're looking for answers that solve the problem rather than bring it down. It's a public health problem. You don't get rid of cancer or heart disease or drunk driving. You just don't eliminate those problems. What you do is just try to lower the rate and lower the incidence and try to make it were a little bit less bad when it does occur. And I think that's how we need to have a realistic sense of what gun control can accomplish in a nation with 350 million guns.
I think this is really important, what you just said about that, that, you know, everybody comes back to the debate after one of these mass shootings. And there's an expectation that we just can't live with this. And let's figure out the one thing that will solve it. And what I hear you saying is, if you're really interested in this, it's sustained attention to trying to decrease the incidence of everyday gun violence. And you may not stop these mass shootings. You may decrease the incidence of them.
I think you want to do everything you can, but we do have to be realistic about the – we've made a deal as a society. I mean, we're selling 25 to 40 million new guns every year. So it's a huge number of guns being introduced into the gun population, a huge number of gun sales that are happening every year. This is an incredibly popular product in America, and it's only become more and more popular in recent years. And it's going to face new challenges with things like new technologies that enable people, for instance, to 3D print their own gun. I think the gun violence problem is one that we need sustained attention to, because there's a number of threats coming from a number of different places.
Adam Winkler is with us. He's a professor of constitutional law at UCLA. We're tapping his expertise on the battle over the right to bear arms in America, which is the title of his book, Gunfight, but also tapping his expertise on the history of corporations in America. And it's actually been a bit of an intersection here with our conversation now. And to John in Minneapolis. John, thanks so much for waiting.
Yeah, of course.
What do you want to ask?
I'm interested in making the point for your guest and more broadly. Citizens United, of course, the thing you hear with it is that, corporations are people too. And then in the gun debate, you have this passionate feeling about the Second Amendment and people's personal right to bear the arms. I have had a relationship and have a relationship with someone that's intimately, they own one of the largest gun parts manufacturers in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It happens to be based here in the Midwest in Iowa. And his point to me when we've talked about guns is that it's not just the guns, it's the thousands of people, not only at his company, but around the world, that make their livings. Mm. And it's not just owners of a business. It's that the interest of the business, yes, is to make money. Shareholders, we always talk about that. That's usually 95% of the conversation. And we talk about the lives lost and those impacted by the tragedies. But what we have to really understand, and this goes with healthcare and everything else, is that we're talking about the economy and people's lives, their ability to pay their bills. And, you know, just like people in the Midwest just happen to live or be born in a small town in Iowa that just so happens to have, you know, these people that build this gun parts manufacturing business up to be a world leader. And it supports the town. It supports the amount of taxes they pay within the state. They support the culture of the state, of the town, of the nation. So
I think it's
wise to have that conversation, because in order to maybe address the issue, we have to get so far into the nitty-gritty about the fact that this is just – some people's lives are so intimately connected to both the business and to the culture at large. And we need to raise their consciousness and our own about their plight as well, in order to probably more broadly address the issue.
So, Adam, what would you say to all that?
Well, it's a very good point. You know, we do think about the gun industry and we think of the gun lobby, but it is important to recognize that some of the gun makers have been really important companies over the course of American history. From Colt and Remington and Smith & Wesson, some of these companies really helped communities. And there is a large culture, but also a large economy based on gun purchasing. Like I say, there's about 25 million background checks conducted every year, suggesting that there's at least 25 million gun sales conducted every year, because not every gun sale requires a background check. So we do have a very thriving business in America, and thriving economy around guns. It's important to note that at least things like universal background checks or beefing up enforcement of our current gun laws or raising the gun age probably would not significantly alter the economics of the gun industry today.
Let me come back to something that I think I said when I was talking about your book on corporations and we've referenced a few times. And I'm realizing as I look at my notes on your book that I misspoke. As you note in the book, the court never actually said that corporations have are people, have personhood. Do I remember that right? That was not in the opinion.
There's been so much controversy since Citizens United over the idea of whether corporations are people, my friend, as Mitt Romney memorably said.
That's right.
But in truth, it actually turns out that when you look through the history of the Supreme Court, I found two surprising things. One, that there is a long history before Citizens United of corporations seeking constitutional rights and winning them in landmark Supreme Court cases. And the second thing was that actually corporate personhood hasn't played that much of a role in those cases, and that usually what the Supreme Court says is that a corporation can have rights in order to protect the rights of other peoples, like the shareholders who associate together within the firm, or to enhance the rights of listeners who might hear corporate speech. And so rarely has the Supreme Court said that corporations as such should have rights because they're corporations, even though the Supreme Court has extended nearly all of our fundamental rights to corporations.
Well, will you talk about what you now understand about the way corporations responded to the Citizens United decision with money and with other activity?
Well, I think, you know, many people expected Citizens United to lead to a corporate takeover of American democracy. You know, that's kind of silly in light of the fact that corporations took over American democracy ages ago. But even seriously, it hasn't led to huge amounts of corporate spending on elections, although it has led to an uptick. It's led to much more individual spending on elections, wealthy individuals spending a tremendous amount of money. But I think Citizens United has inspired corporations to be more aggressive in seeking to protect their interests in courts. And we've seen cases like since then the Hobby Lobby case, giving corporations now religious freedom rights.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a case now before the Supreme Court involving a bakery that refused to sell a cake to a same-sex couple who was seeking to buy a wedding cake. Again, a case that's about the rights of a corporation. And so we're seeing, especially in the gay rights debate, more and more corporations assert their constitutional rights. And I think that's at least in part inspired by Citizens United.
You remember, of course, I think you write about it in the book, President Obama calling out the Citizens United decision in front of the members of the court during a State of the Union speech. And polling still, I mean, it's kind of it's a trigger word, right? Citizens United for a lot of average Americans. How well do we understand what the implications have been? How well did President Obama really phrase what the implications were of the decision? Has it played out the way he thought it would?
Well, President Obama did express concerns about opening up the floodgates, and we have seen a tremendous amount of new spending on elections. And he expressed concerns about foreign interests being able to use Citizens United to fund election ads through American corporations. And we've seen some of that as well. Perhaps what we didn't necessarily perhaps one of the difficulties in assessing the impact of Citizens United is that there is a lot of dark money. We don't have a disclosure system that really shows us when corporations are giving money and when they're spending money. And so sometimes it's hard to really assess where the money is going and how it's having an influence.
Question here for you from Leo in St. Cloud. And Leo, you're back to the history on gun legislation. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. What do you want to know?
Are there any parallels or wisdom that can be had from alcohol prohibition back in the 1930s that didn't work but created more regulation and control because of the known, you know, cultural or community damages, personal damage? And, you know, an example of that, I guess, I don't know when the drunk driving laws came into being, but certainly there's a lot of carnage with around drunk driving. So I don't know. That's my question.
Okay.
Well, it's a great question. In thinking about prohibition, I think it has lessons for both the story about corporations and for guns. I mean, on the story of corporations, one of the things I found a surprising set of cases 100 years ago where corporations that were looking to spend money to influence local elections in the run-up to prohibition challenged campaign finance laws restricting corporate money in elections a century before Citizens United. Back then, of course, the courts said corporations did not have the right to influence elections. It's a principle the Supreme Court today has forgotten. And then once prohibition was adopted, I think it provides a lesson for how we think about the world of guns and gun policy. I still think there's many Americans who think the answer is to get rid of all the guns, the way we tried to get rid of all alcohol. And I think it's really hard, we learned from prohibition, to prohibit small, easy-to-conceal things that people feel really passionate about. And I think an effort to ban guns, a widespread effort to ban guns, would meet the same fate, unfortunately, as our widespread effort to ban alcohol.
You know, I'm surprised to hear you say that you think there are a significant number of Americans who think just banning guns is the answer. That seems so impractical and impossible at the moment.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think one of the things we've seen over the last 30, 40 years in the gun debate is a decreasing number of Americans supporting broad bans on things like handguns. There is still support for things like restrictions on military-style rifles. But again, those are a minority of the guns out there, and they're responsible for only a fraction of gun deaths. So we have seen a real moderation by gun control forces moving away from advocacy for total civilian disarmament, which was the goal in the 1970s of the gun violence prevention movement, even as the NRA has become more extreme in the other direction.
I mean, you do hear people in the wake of Parkland cite what happened in Australia as an example of what the United States could do. That's not going to happen, is it?
Well, it's not going to happen. It's not clear that it would have the same impact. So Australia had about 3.5 million guns, and they did a major buyback of various kinds of high-capacity magazines and military-style assault rifles, and bought back about 800,000 guns. But since that time, the number of guns have gone back up to about 3.5 million. Huh. And given the fact that most mass shootings worldwide are conducted with or committed with a handgun, and handguns still remain widespread in Australia, it's kind of hard to believe that that a mass shooter, if they really wanted to, couldn't get a gun and commit a horrible offense there too.
Call here from Jennifer in Stillwater. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, yeah, I just wanted to say that the Constitution is not stuck in time. If it were, women could not vote, black people would still be slaves. You know, it's absurd that we should be beaten over the head with our own Constitution from hundreds of years ago. You know, France has had, you know, a couple dozen constitutions since, many dozens of constitutions since 1789. But anyway, this is, you know, like the previous caller said, you know, he was talking about people employed in Iowa and the gun jobs. You know, it's white male conservative entitlement that they think they're entitled to, well, jobs. But, you know, what about children's entitlement to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in the Declaration of Independence? The Constitution referred to a well-regulated militia because we had no standing army. So people had to come out of their houses and protect themselves against the British. It was not a right to, you know, individual bear arms. The Heller decision is wrong, just like Bush v. Gore was wrong.
Okay. Jennifer, you've put your finger on, again, something that I wanted to get to, which is how these varied interpretations remain so unresolved, Adam, but come up anew, you know, after one of these shootings. How do we resolve these different interpretations? We don't. Go ahead.
Well, you know, the caller is right that we often filter these debates through the lens of the Constitution, especially on issues of guns. We think about this often in terms of the Second Amendment. One thing I would remind is that even if we were to overturn the Second Amendment, eliminate the Second Amendment today, it probably wouldn't change American politics very much if you think about it in this way. Hmm. The Second Amendment is not being used by the courts to strike down a wide number of gun control laws. In fact, the Second Amendment's been read to allow most forms of gun control laws, including things like bans on assault weapons and bans on high-capacity magazines and universal background checks, virtually everything the current gun violence prevention movement wants. So it's not the Second Amendment that leads to strong strong gun rights in America. It's a political mobilization and a group of people who've been fighting for this in state legislatures and in Congress for 30 years. And you could get rid of the Second Amendment tomorrow, and it doesn't change the gun laws of Alabama or Mississippi or Georgia. The gun rights advocates are still going to push for broad protections for gun owners.
You open that 2012 book, Gunfight, with this sentence. On December 14th, 2012, America's debate over guns was transformed. Looking back, was it as transformed as you thought?
I think it has been transformed, and we're seeing the results of that over the last few weeks. What happened after Newtown was no new federal laws got passed, and that's frustrated a lot of people, understandably. But it masks a couple things. One, there's been pretty vigorous reform at the state level, and about the states that cover about 40% of Americans have enacted new, more restrictive laws of the sort that President Obama wanted after Newtown. And we've also seen a real reinvigoration of the gun debate. Remember in 2008 and even in 2012, President Obama did not talk about gun control on the campaign trail. Now it's become a central issue for the Democratic Party. And we're seeing new money in the gun violence prevention space. Gabrielle Giffords has a super PAC. Mm-hmm. We're seeing Michael Bloomberg outspend the NRA on some elections. So we are seeing a real renewed gun debate. And this mobilization over the last few weeks probably wouldn't have happened had the gun violence prevention movement not been shored up with a lot more money and a lot more organization over the last 4 or 5 years.
I hear you on what you're saying about what's happening at state legislatures, but I saw a statistic yesterday that said there are 19 states that have passed 63 gun access, providing more access to guns in those states. So it seems that while there might be what I think you would consider progress in some state capitals, there are states that are responding to news of this to say, well, our citizens need more access to guns.
That's right. There was a study about 2 years ago or a year or so ago about that looked at all the gun laws at the state level that were adopted since Newtown and actually found that the majority of gun laws that were passed made laws more permissive, made it easier to access and carry your guns around. So, that's right. At the state level, we're very polarized. We do have this red state, blue state phenomenon. And on the issue of guns, perhaps more than any other, we see that divide come to fruition. And that's why when you see a place like Florida actually propose to raise the gun age, it's a pretty significant movement. Florida's been really ground zero for the gun rights movement for a long time, been a real leader in opposing new gun control laws at every turn. So that kind of change can make a difference.
I did have one last question for your read on what's happening in Florida. Was it the voices of these students? Was it the level of the carnage coming so quickly after Las Vegas and some of these other shootings? What do you think really was the tipping point in a state that you just said is ground zero?
I think it was the students. I mean, Orlando was also in
and
Florida,
Orlando,
the Pulse shooting,
right.
And that was worse in terms of violence. And that didn't lead Florida lawmakers to do anything. I think that these students have invigorated the gun debate even more, breathed new life into a movement that was already coming alive since the Newtown shooting. And you see it nationwide. I mean, I've received so many calls from students all over the country who want to organize events around March 14th.
Hmm.
24th, to say enough.
Right? Is it the 14th
or the
24th?
There's the 14th school protests and walkouts, and then there's the 24th march on Washington, I believe.
Adam, I thank you so much. Thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thank you for having me.
Adam Winkler's new book is called We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights and Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. If you missed that discussion yesterday, where we talked about the politics and the policy and the influence in Washington and state legislatures of the NRA, you can find it on the podcast. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller, wherever you get your podcasts.